Hello and welcome to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. This is my colleague and co-host, Sam Wong.
Sam Wong of the Neuroscience Institute and the Princeton Gerrymandering Project.
Well, today, Sam, for our first recorded show in 2019, we have a very special episode of Politics and Polls. We're going to dive deep into an issue that's been central to the show since we started, not only political polarization in Washington, but also more broadly, how we've become so deeply divided along political, economic, social, and cultural lines. Why are there so many fault lines in American society? Why do they seem worse than ever before? Are they worse than ever before? And where did these divisions come from? And while many people understand these kinds of fault lines in a short-term perspective, they're the result of the current president or the last president, or they are the result of some event that happens. Historians take a longer view usually, and they look at problems and tensions that have been building in society over many decades. So the reason the episode's a little different than our normal ones is one of the two guests for today will include myself, and the other guest is Princeton historian Kevin Cruz, and the two of us have a new book out called Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974. I'm hoping I got the title right. And that's out with Norton this week. It's available everywhere, online and in bookstores. And I'm going to turn the interview over to you, Sam, so that you can speak to us a little bit about the book.
Yes, I speak from the vantage point of someone who has read the book but not written it, so that makes me unique among the three of us, and it makes me the most like the listeners, so that's a good thing.
That's true.
All right. So, look, this is a terrific book. I enjoyed it quite a lot. It's absorbing, and I will say, as somebody born in 1967, I was really fascinated to read a history of events within my own lifetime. And I have to open just with some just basic grounding here. I mean, the two of you are prominent historians, and here you are, firstly, writing together, and secondly, writing about a time when I believe we were all alive. So just to first, before getting into the book a little bit, lightning round. Julian, what year were you born?
I was born in 1969, so right before this all starts.
Okay, and Kevin?
1972.
Ah, a child. All right.
Yes.
So I'm curious, to back up a little bit. So now we've established you were born before the events in question, which is already interesting from a historian's perspective. Kevin, tell me, how did the two of you come to write this book together? What brought you together from your own vantage points on American history?
Well, it really came out of a course that we taught together. You know, when I got here, I started in 2000, and I inherited a course that I think had been in the book since the 1960s, and it was simply titled The United States Since 1920. And in 1960, that was a manageable bit of time for an advanced history course here. But you add 4 or 5 more decades to that, and it gets a little unwieldy. And so Julie and I had a couple conversations about taking that course I had and splitting it in two. And we decided that we would split it in two around Watergate, because there was a Fisher Point for not just for Watergate, but for a lot of other things that go on in the early 70s, some real seismic shifts. And that we would start teaching a course together these first few years, which was the U.S. since 1974. And the reason we did that was that we thought it was finally time to stop taking these recent decades, these decades of our own lives, to stop treating them as a coda, as an afterthought to this long 20th century course, and instead realized that enough time had passed, enough had happened, that this was its own discrete period, and we needed to start thinking of it as such. And so we wanted to really push that.
How much time have you spent in your previous writings on such recent events? Because it strikes me that it's a special challenge to historians to write about things that they themselves saw in real time.
You know, again, it had always been kind of the coda. So my first book was a book about Southern politics, and the epilogue kind of had a quick hot skip and jump up through Newt Gingrich and George W. Bush. My last book was on the religious right, and it had a very quick coda that took things up through Obama and into what was in the present. So, again, it was a territory that I've been familiar with in my own writing. But it was one that was always done kind of tacked on at the urging of a publisher. You know, you've got to bring this up to the present, and it's a task most historians I think, are familiar with. And instead we thought, rather than just kind of treat this as the epilogue, let's really dig in.
And Julian, tell me about your teaching at that time, when at this moment, and also this movement into modern times. I want to hear about that.
Yeah, so I came to Princeton not long before we started teaching this course. And so I loved the idea of starting a course rather than finishing a course with the 1970s. A lot of my scholarship tends to focus on this period, so it's not a coda for me. In a lot of my writings, I actually go into the 70s and 80s and even the 90s. I've edited books on presidents who have served recently. I wrote a book on Carter. I edited a book on Bush and even on Obama. So part of my interest always, both in the classroom and in my writing, is how do you write and think as a historian about this period, a period we lived through, and a period that if you take a history class in high school, usually drops off in the 1960s, or it did for a long time. But it's also just a realization, and all of us in the classroom know this, that for the people in the classroom, this isn't actually modern history. The 1970s is now a long way away. And this is like when we were in the classroom, Kevin and I, and we were learning about, you know, the 1950s or the 1960s or earlier. So the time has come to teach people about this and to write about it. And so it was very natural for me to move away from kind of case studies, which is what I usually write about, to just thinking of the entire period from the time Nixon stepped down, a traumatic moment in American history, right through our epilogue that takes us through year one of President Trump.
Yeah, I find it all quite striking because my own, I was born in 1967, and my own earliest political memory is of watching Nixon resign on television. And now I talk to undergraduates, as both of you do here at Princeton, and I was at one point explaining to somebody the government shutdown, and it occurred to me that this is somebody who is not very far from herself becoming congressional staff. And the fact that I had to explain the 1995-96 shutdown, and this was also, you know, at some level for these kids that were these students we're teaching now, the current political situation, the fault lines that are at the heart of your book, that's what they know as being the normal state of politics.
Right.
Yeah. And so you know, this transition is kind of interesting. Let's dive into the book just a little tiny bit, get started on a few things. Kevin, I'm curious about, at the beginning of the book, you guys talk about Obama's farewell address, and Obama lays out these divisions in society that are still present. Tell me a little bit about these fault lines and how they've changed in the last 50 years. Let's just take a really broad sweep and then let's dive in a little bit.
Sure. So in Obama's farewell address, he identifies three major lines of division, political, economic, and racial. And we added a fourth line of gender and sexuality. And we see these as really the through lines for the book. And they definitely change over time. And what happens is that in the start of the 70s, there's a series of ruptures on all four of those fronts. The political establishment is just ravaged by not just Watergate, but by the failures in Vietnam. The economy is shattered by the rise of deindustrialization and the energy crisis of the 70s, which seems to cripple the United States. The United States seems suddenly beholden to foreign powers and not able to stand on its own. It's getting eclipsed by, you know, by the car industry is being eclipsed by West Germany and Japan. There are all these new rivals on the horizon. Racially, that was actually a line that seemed to be positive in the 70s, as the old lines of discrimination and segregation fell apart, and you get this new world of diversity. And then that fourth line of gender and sexuality is one in which the country is really first rocked by the rise of feminism and the movements for gay and lesbian rights. But then there's a counter movement, obviously, from the right all over this politics of family values. So across the board, all these old institutions and norms that had really, we already kept the country together in the post-war period after World War II, really all suddenly crumble at once. And there's a new movement that is built out of its wake. And it's not a movement to put those pieces back together. It's instead a new country that comes to not only accept but welcome what our colleague Dan Rogers has called the age of fracture, and that these new lines of division quickly begin to widen, in fact.
So, Kevin, it seems to me that racial changes starting in the 70s, that fault line seems to have at least its immediate antecedent to be the Civil Rights Act and the civil rights movement of the 60s. So that seems like a long time ago. Talk about how through the book and your own scholarship, how has race evolved since the 1970s in that arc from that time to now?
Well, it's evolved in a number of interesting ways. I think one of the most fundamentally important ones is that the landmark successes of the civil rights era were in many ways seen as being complete and overwhelming. And many people assumed that all the problems have been solved. This is the way in which we remember Martin Luther King in popular culture, that, you know, we see him frozen in the 1963 March on Washington, boiling the problems down simply to his children being judged by the color of their skin. If we can just get past that, we can all get along. And that's a partial image of that, of what the real civil rights struggle was about. There was a lot of unfinished issues on the agenda. But what the civil rights triumphs do is they lead a lot of people to believe that racial turmoil is in the past. And we see this throughout the modern era. You certainly see it after the election of Barack Obama, where there's suddenly a belief that, and naively expressed in the media, if you look back at the election coverage as we did, to see that people are celebrating this as a moment of triumph that we finally put America's original sin of slavery to rest. We have a black president. All the problems are solved. And so there's this continued attitude of things have finally triumphed, finally gotten better. But it's also punctuated by a counter movement of racial resentment, of racial retrenchment.
And do you think that, Kevin, do you think that we're over this particular illusion now with the rise of Donald Trump and white nationalists having some kind of say on the national scene?
I think we absolutely are. And again, this is, you mentioned my larger work. My first book was a study of white supremacists, and the opening chapters details a neo-Nazi group after World War II and the Ku Klux Klan and these organizations that rise up in the 40s and then get replaced by a more respectable, more subtle form of racism, and they go underground. And when I wrote that book in 2005, a lot of people faulted me for even bringing those people into the discussion. Well, those are marginal groups. They don't exist anymore. They're not important anymore. You can't tie that to the mainstream of the conservative view of race. But now we've seen those groups are back alive and thriving in the contemporary moment. And I think that does show that we were incredibly naive, all of us to one degree or another, to think that they had been laid to rest.
Now, Kevin, you painted this as your fourth fault line that you all added as the addition of feminism and gay rights as being in addition to those three fault lines, political, economic, and racial. But Julian, tell me about the way that feminism and gays came into gay rights came into the picture, and how those social movements then entered the stage. Because it seems like part of the same story as race to me, the story of rights. So let's hear about that a little bit.
It is, and the two movements aren't exactly the same. So feminism really is flourishing in the 1970s. This is, it's one of these decades where a lot's happening, even though it's often been a hiccup, the way people think of it in between the 60s and the 80s. And feminism really, it grows directly out of the civil rights movement, even though it's often a critique of civil rights leaders too, and has a whole other set of concerns. But you see in the 1970s that feminism really starts to gain a strong foothold. Groups like NOW become organizationally very sophisticated. The membership of groups that are pushing for everything from pro-choice positions and abortion rights to issues at the workplace to protect women workers are really growing pretty exponentially. And just as important, they're transforming the way Americans think about what problems are and turning to issues such as the family, such as personal interactions between employees and bosses, and really putting them on the table. And Ms. Magazine will feature a piece on sexual harassment in the late 1970s. And you can see the impact they're having. The gay rights movement is also emerging during this period as well. The famous starting point is always the Stonewall Riot in the 1960s, but it's in the 1970s that you see gay rights as a movement really take hold, using civil rights methods often, using a similar kind of grassroots energy, but opening up a whole other set of questions. And finally, with gay rights, the kind of next stage, which Kevin and I write a lot about, is the AIDS crisis of the 1980s, where you really see the movement start to have a pretty dramatic political impact when the Reagan administration is simply refusing to deal with this devastating disease that's taking hold. People like Larry Speaks of the administration literally are mocking gay Americans, the whole idea of the disease. And with the formation of groups like ACT UP, they put the administration's feet to the fire. And by the late 1980s, early 1990s, the convergence of the gay rights movement and policy is clear as you start to see real serious federal funding starting to flow for AIDS. And so those are, in retrospect, stories that might not totally have been appreciated, but I think anyone living in 2019 can see how they were fundamentally transforming social norms.
So, Julian, the thing that strikes me here is that when you write about these things, you write about these very specific events that happen, like the AIDS crisis and so on. But I'm trying to think here from a historian's perspective: race, feminism, gay rights. Is there some deeper cause here that made it possible for the United States to go down these paths, like post-war expansion? Like, what was the thing that made it possible for us as a nation to start thinking about these things in new ways and start disrupting the old order?
Yeah, the great thing about, and Kevin might have a different answer, but I often, when I'm talking with social scientists, and we've talked about this on the air, is historians don't tend to give you one single causal answer about why everything happened or why an era changed. And lots of different things were at work. And so it's a combination of the impact these social movements could have. And part of it was just the success of organizing, the sophistication of the media messages of groups like the gay rights, the different parts of the gay rights movement, individuals like Larry Kramer, who just figured out, how do you turn these amorphous concerns into something that in specific communities would really matter? So the grassroots mattered. I think the impact of the economic crisis of the 70s, this was a terrible decade in the economy. We had just gone through two real decades of total economic growth, at least, and then through the late 1960s. And in the 70s, everything is just terrible. We have a combination of inflation and unemployment, which economists said you could never have. It's called stagflation. And I think the depth of the economic crisis unsettled all these institutions, from government to the middle class, to the security Americans felt. And I think in addition to grassroots activism, that just opened up a lot of debates that had previously been a bit muted because the economy was so strong. And one last thing. You're living in the aftermath of the civil rights movement. I think this is something Kevin and I have both written about in different ways, that the civil rights movement, it wasn't simply about race relations. It opened up all kinds of questions about social justice and rights that then spawned all these different kinds of demands and questions about what America is that we're still living with today.
Strikes me. Kevin, do you have any counterpoint to that?
No, I would just echo, I would agree with what Julian had said there, and I think you can tie a couple of things together. So if you think about the way in which feminism develops, there's often a common misunderstanding that feminism arrives in the 60s, and then suddenly all these women wind up going into the workplace. It's actually the other way around. It's because the job structure in America changes so much that by 1976, only like 40% of jobs in America provide enough salary to support a family of four, that you've got more and more women who are forced to go into the workplace. And once they're there in the workplace, they now are experiencing discrimination and now experiencing all sorts of sexual harassment and things like that, that they find the incentive in a lot of ways for what becomes kind of an economically driven feminism. And then they model that in a lot of ways on the successes of the civil rights movement. So again, as Julian said, it's a classic historian's answer to say it's not really one thing, but it's this confluence of events.
Yeah, it actually reminds me of what's happening right now with the presidential campaign, where Elizabeth Warren has declared her candidacy, and she's made the specific point that a single woman raising a child and making minimum wage cannot lift that child out of poverty. And so these issues seem to be, you know, very much in a very 70s-ish sort of way with us. So one thing that strikes me here is that, me being a scientist coming at this from an external perspective, I'm looking for some kind of big global driving force here. Like an example that really comes to mind a lot is survey evidence showing a public lack of trust in institutions, whether it be medicine or government, post-Watergate, other sources of authority. There's just a broad across-the-board decline of trust in institutions. Just the other day on my newsfeed, Ariel Edwards-Levy showed some survey data showing that trust in congressmen, individual members of Congress, was something like 70% 50 years ago. And now is down to 20%. Just this massive loss of trust in institutions. So I want to use that to pivot to ways that our institutions have fragmented. And I want to, because you guys wrote about it a lot, I want to turn to the way that we get our information, because that strikes me as being closely related to losing this trust in institutions. So Julian, I want to get you on the topic of how the news industry has changed during the period of your book since the 1970s. Let's hear about the evolution of news.
Yeah, this is one of the big stories of the book, the history of the news industry, that I think didn't start as a theme for us, but the more we wrote, the more it came out as a topic. And so there's different stages of how the news has evolved in how it became much more fragmented, how much became unfiltered, and also in some ways parts of it commercialized. You know, there's key moments. One key moment we talk about is that early 1980s period. We talk about the advent of CNN. It comes on the air on June 1st, 1980. And this is really an important turning point in that it changes the news cycle. And the news cycle used to be controlled by three television networks that did about 22 minutes of news every evening and a handful of newspapers. And so the flow of news was pretty limited. It was only in part of the day, where after 1980, it's the Wild West in terms of how much time will be available to talk about news. And at the same time, the next year, this channel called MTV goes on the air. And why is that important to information? Because it really promotes a new idea of narrowcasting, meaning information on at least television news will focus on particular people, particular populations, rather than trying to get the entire nation. So the early 80s is important. Then we go to the 90s. We talk about the advent of Fox News in 1996. As after you now have an unlimited news cycle, you start to really see the development of partisan news at a level that we had not seen it in earlier periods, at least in the 20th century. We've seen it in the 19th century, where you have news channels like Fox that are explicitly promoting a partisan point of view. And that will be replicated. Liberals will try it with MSNBC and Air America. And you'll see this become a much more important part of the political news media universe. And then finally, later in the book, we move to the final stage in some ways, which is the internet, from everything Twitter to blogging and online newspapers, where the editorial filters that we used to have, the production filters, are gone. Everyone can get information. They can get it out at a mass level. So these three things, cumulative, really created a much more fragmented, uncontrollable media universe, which is where we live today. But it was really, you know, over three decades in the making that this all happened.
In your book, there's this little vignette, which I had not really quite appreciated, about Ted Turner starting CNN what, in 1980, and he owns a sports team, right? And he's desperate for content, and he's got to do something with all this air hours, right? Did you write this part, Kevin, that, like, there's this part about, like, just, like, sticking hours and hours of, what kind of team was it?
The Atlanta Braves.
Yeah, right. Okay, so, like, all these Braves games, and then, like, Braves games being rebroadcast. And so, okay, that'll be good for a few more hours. And so it's interesting to see the evolution of, at some level, I think these businessmen and businesswomen, businessmen mostly, figuring out what's possible with this narrow casting of views. So Kevin, I know you've written about cable news and fracturing. Like, how do you see? It strikes me that that's a pretty important part of the story of how we broke up as a society.
Yeah, and it goes back to what Julian raised, which was this issue that really comes into focus with MTV. They're quite explicit about this narrow casting appeal. And it's one that you can clearly recognize in cable where, you know, especially today you've got, you know, originally it was 30 or 40 channels and now it's, you know, 500, 600, whatever. And so there's a channel for every interest, there's a channel for every personality, there's a channel for every hobby. And what that means is that the media world is incredibly siloed. And we clearly see that most obviously in the news world. And so this is one of the issues that we raise in the book is that we mean fault lines, not just in terms of the lines that divide us, but the lines that people are telling each other about who's at fault for all these changes. And so, you know, you've got CNN and MSNBC and Fox News, obviously, and a host of other imitators across the spectrum now that are in a lot of ways preaching to the choir. And so people are getting a different perspective, and it's a radical change from where we begin in the period where you've got the big three networks and you've got just one evening news program on each network, and they largely all follow not literally the same script but pretty close to it. And instead you've got this 24/7 landscape with hundreds of channels, and they're all competing for attention, and not just on cable news but on talk radio. And then on the internet, and now social media, where it's not even news organizations, it's anyone with an account can spread information, can be a citizen reporter, right? Which is good in some ways, it's liberating, but it's also just a incredibly chaotic, and it's hard to find any kind of common ground with that kind of world.
And the funny thing is, I mean, and we try to capture where this comes from, And a lot of the origins, it was very much an effort to liberate or open up at least a media world that many people in the 70s thought has been really constrained. So now we look back to the era of Walter Cronkite and everyone reveres the network era. But in the 70s, many people were frustrated with that. They thought that the news had missed a lot of big stories, that if only a few channels and newspapers controlled everything, you really wouldn't have a plurality of voices. And we have a quote from the editor of Rolling Stone who said, we have a big three in New York, just as we have a big three in Detroit. And what has happened to news is no different from what has happened to cars. We're offered products that are essentially similar, inefficient, unresponsive to the public interest. And he continues that all the networks were seeking the same audience, so they drove reporting to the middle, he said. And the diversity of views and competition for ideas that represented a wider range of opinions in the general public. He said we should have a half dozen or a dozen networks, and he proposes in which there will be aggressive competition for news on which the interest, ideological and otherwise, of smaller populations, and he has young people, old people, women, conservatives, and more are reflected. And this is a part of what you see in history. It's not always a straight line in terms of where things start and where they wanted to end up. There were many people who didn't believe those old institutions were working. And even though the media wouldn't often accomplish what people hoped, the idea of fragmentation was very appealing in the 1970s as an alternative to a stale kind of consensus. And it was the same in politics. In the 70s, everyone wanted more partisanship. They thought bipartisanship got us into Vietnam. It stopped progress on civil rights. So they wanted to create parties that promoted partisanship. And these are the kinds of stories we try to capture in the book.
Well, let me return to the thing that I mentioned before, Julian, about lack of trust in institutions. As decline in trust as institutions has been this big trend in the last several decades, could it be that the thing that drives that in turn is the ability of individual groups to find their voice, the ability of one conversation to turn into dozens of conversations? Maybe I wonder if that is the thing that's really driving a number of these fault lines, where we used to have one national conversation and we don't anymore. So, you know, and that sometimes that's because a racial group gets its say. Sometimes it's because the right wing gets its say. How does that strike you as a and I know you're a historian, let's be careful here, as a big explanation?
Well, it's amplifying it, but I think the reason we start...
Wait, so you're saying that we wouldn't have it without, it would happen even without talk radio and cable? We could still have these things?
Yeah, I think so, because look, the starting point of our book is a very specific moment. It's when Richard Nixon, the president of the United States, resigns in the middle of his second term. Watergate was, without any question, an incredibly traumatic scandal for this country, and it follows a decade of really contentious fights over Vietnam and civil rights, which had raised all sorts of skepticism and anger from both conservatives and liberals about any idea or any concept of shared values, and certainly in the institutions we trusted. And so that happens before the media fragments. That happens before a lot of the trends we're talking about really fully take hold. That's the starting point. So there is a traumatic origin story, I think, that needs to be explained. The media alone doesn't divide us. We were on that path already. And the media really, now the way it's unfolded, accelerates these divisions. And they become the arena in which we have these battles. And so they're very sympathetic to the divisions, but I don't think they're the only reason we're divided.
I see. Media didn't kill society. Society killed society.
And the media provided a platform to talk about it all the time.
I'm somewhat skeptical the way I am skeptical about gun rights defenders who say that, no, it's not the guns, it's the people. So, Kevin, let's take go down another little path in the time we have left. Another whole thread here that goes through your book is the whole thread of what the fault lines look like from the standpoint of conservatives and the religious right. So that's a story that's really merged up with the Republican Party. And I want to hear you talk a little bit about that thread as it unfolds through your book.
Sure. Well, I think there are a couple important things to think about here. One, and this follows off some work that both of us have done, especially Julian and Meg Jacobs did a book on the Reagan administration, is that we push back against the notion that this is an era of solely conservative dominance. I think the traditional narrative has been one in which the Reagan revolution changes all things, and it's an era in which liberalism is on the run, is solely reactive, is following the script of conservatism. And what we find here is that there's a certain stickiness to liberal institutions and liberal ideas. And so the old New Deal order isn't swept away. And so what you have is rather than a conservative dominance, it's more of a kind of a long-running civil war between liberals and conservatives, in which they take on different shapes. Another theme is that we can't think of conservatism in the singular. And this is something that I've done throughout my work, is really to think about the way in which there are multiple competing strands of conservatism. It's conservatisms, you know, plural. And so we've got, you know, the kind of the free market conservatives, we've got national security emphasis, we've got libertarians, and we've got the social conservatives of the religious right. And that's a thread that becomes stronger and stronger throughout the book. But it's really one of many that are in competition within the party.
And does it strike you, Kevin, that these things have now, circa 2019, these different threads were separate, but seems like they've really, frankly, consolidated around race? Because if I think about the dominance of business interests, if I think about the religious right, like there really does, the consensus point appears to be, you know, whiteness. And so are there exceptions to this? Was this how did we get here?
Well, I think there are certain ways in which race really has come to the fore. And in a lot of ways, race had always been there. You know, the origin story of the religious right that they like to tell is that they were really motivated by abortion. But if you look back to the origins, it really is a fight with the IRS over religious schools, which had largely been founded across the South as segregation academies, as ways to avoid the integration of public schools. So in a lot of ways, race had been there from the beginning. But it's not solely about race. Again, this is the historian talking with multiple variables here. And so you can look at a strand of conservatism, say, look at the administration of George W. Bush, which really did make, I think, a sincere effort to broaden the party's racial identity, to move beyond a kind of white backlash identity that had really been dominant in the 70s and 80s, and really look to diversify it. And there was a push for immigration reform under Bush that failed and led to a sharp backlash, and I think probably got us to where we are today. But it was a drive that he pushed, and it was something seen in his own administration with members like Condi Rice and Colin Powell and Alberto Gonzalez, Michael Steele later on as head of the RNC. So there's a movement within the Republican Party to really move beyond that. But in a lot of ways, it's a counter note. And so even though we still have today, you have figures like Marco Rubio or Tim Scott or Nikki Haley, who really do present a face of a vibrant, multiracial Republican Party. In a lot of ways, they're on the defensive now. And what Trump has done is has tapped back into that older current of white backlash and really made it much more prominent. And I think what we've seen with the 2018 midterms, you only have to look at the faces of the incoming classes, is that the Republicans have really gone back to that old style in which they really are the party dominated by largely white men.
And just to jump in on that, I think what Kevin is talking about and this story in our book is really important to getting back to the question you asked about is the media, is our communication the primary source? I think we're saying there are some pretty real and very serious divisions in American society. We tell stories that don't fit neatly with just the triumph of conservatism story about American politics. In the 1980s, we look at how Reagan, for example, constantly encountered very serious opposition, whether we were writing about the rise of the ACT UP movement or whether we're talking about the nuclear freeze and the opposition to a lot of his foreign policy. We look at the divisions Kevin's talking about within each of these parts of the political spectrum, right and left. We even talk about, you know, one of the reasons the moral majority is so angry is they're not actually winning on pop culture. We look at pop culture in the 1980s and 90s and show how sexuality is pretty pervasive and acceptable, and the norms that Jerry Falwell was pushing don't, you know, get embraced by a lot of the country. And so there are real points of division which continue through today. They're not imagined. They're not just fomented. I think they reflect unanswered questions that come out of the period where we start the book.
Well, Julian, but so let's see. So losing on morals, but then what? Winning on issues of economics and race. So, for instance, you have an interest in the decline of unions and manufacturing in the United States. So it seems like for Republicans, those have become issues that matter to them, not only race, but also this business of economic contraction and disruptions to society as the economy has changed for some, but not everyone.
Yeah, that's clearly a huge point of victory. Again, it's not an area of total agreement. And the kind of direction of economic policy under Republican administrations, tax cuts, deregulation, and the like has been contested. But yes, that has, if there's one part of our story where we come back to different periods of politics and presidents since the 70s, where the Republicans have been pretty united and been more victorious than in other areas, I'd say that is the best example. Although again, it's not a united acceptance of these policies at all.
Now I want to hear from you, just Julian, if it's okay, just a little bit more about ways these things play out. One thing that comes up that's on my mind a lot this week anyway is government shutdowns. We're currently, let's see, I think we have on our hands the third longest federal government shutdown in history. And then above it on the ranked list is the 1995-96 government shutdown. So how did these different forces come together? What did that shutdown look like from the Republican side? Evidently, they thought it was great.
Yeah, that the the shutdown of 95 and 96 is in our book, and it's an important moment. It comes after Republicans had been in the minority of Congress for most of the period from 1954 through 1994. And in 94, Republicans gained the House and the Senate for the first time in this era. And Newt Gingrich is the speaker. He's named the Speaker of the House. He had been a principal mover behind the new Republican Party. Bill Clinton is in office. Clinton had a troubled first term. He had a failed effort at passing a health care bill. He raised taxes, which angered many conservatives. After 94, they have a showdown over the federal budget. Republicans want to put pretty severe cuts in the Medicare program. Bill Clinton realizes this is his moment to try to stand firm against a Republican Party after he looked to be on the defensive since 1994. And so there's a shutdown, which is our longest shutdown. And the way it plays out is the media covers the shutdown as it unfolds. It talks less about are you for or against the government shutting down than what does it mean for the government to shut down? How does it affect people who are trying to visit a national park or national zoo? How does it affect people who are trying to travel or get access to basic government services? And the public turns against the Republicans. And the Republicans will back away from it. It's a huge blow to Gingrich, who had been emboldened after the 94 midterm elections and all of a sudden is defeated because at least for the time being in 96, he has to concede and Clinton has his first major victory. So what's interesting in retrospect to me, I've been thinking a little bit about this, is that Clinton stood firm in that period, really with the goal of protecting existing programs, as opposed to what we see today, where President Trump is now trying to legislate using a shutdown, meaning get something new rather than defend something that's in place. And second, the Republicans were responsive to public pressure. The public turned against them. They agreed to back down. And today, it's not clear that dynamic will work. It's really an interesting shift in the party. And it already, just to remember, by the mid-1990s, most observers already said the Republican Party had really moved very far to the right, was pretty extreme in its tactics. The shutdown was a dramatic moment in the mid-1990s when many people were like, I can't believe this is happening. Whereas today, it's a normal tool of combat.
So are we at a moment in history when that is going to be realized to be something that both sides, that will this fault line heal over a little bit now that it's recognized as a sort of a Trumpy thing to shut down the government?
I don't know. I'm not convinced of that. Right. I mean, I think that's kind of our point is these trends are really cooked in our country and they're not going to go away even with the president.
All right. Well, despite the fairly damning case that you have both laid out in this book, I'm going to close with a quick question for either of you about ways to get across those fault lines. And I recognize that you might just say, now we're cooked. But Kevin, in whatever domain it might be, race, religion, conservatism, is there a way across these fault lines that you see in the next 10 years, are there any green shoots in this weird Trumpian moment? And I'm going to ask Julian the same thing. So, but Kevin, you win the sweepstakes. You get to answer this question first. Anything?
All right, I'll throw you a line. I'll be a little positive here. I do think we see a possible silver lining in the current moment we're in is that Americans are finally starting to care about politics again, and not just in terms of knee-jerk partisanship, but actually realizing that they themselves have a role in this. They're not rooting for a distant team in Washington, D.C., but they can actually get involved and do things. And I think that holds the promise for some sort of transformational change. We certainly see millennials are much more engaged than previous generations at this age, I think, and that the groups that have been really on the margins for the last couple of decades, whether it be through the Black Lives Matter movement or through the Me Too movement or the Women's March or things like that, they really have become much more engaged. And I think that is going to force a change in our current state. I'm not sure it's going to mean the end of the fault lines, but I think the lines will, at the very least, be moving considerably into new directions.
Okay, Julian, your turn to be an optimist.
Well, that answer by Kevin's excellent, and I agree. But I guess the other way to think about it, in the book that we have written, there's many really good, important moments that happen in this divisive period. And whether we're talking about real technological changes, such as the development of computers and the PC, which we write a lot about, which I think still have had fundamentally good impacts, to the emergence of new ideas of social justice and rights in the middle of this divisive period, it shows to me that, you know, even in the middle of this, even in the middle of this kind of contentious moment or era, good things can still happen. And it isn't a total shackle on the progress of society. And so that's how I look back at what we wrote and what we're trying to teach about, in addition to whatever might happen in terms of changing the status quo.
Technology, huh? All right. Well, okay. So we're sunk.
We'll see. We'll be a little optimistic, but I think we're out of time. So I'll shift back to my concluding person mode. And Sam, I'll thank you for this terrific interview. And Kevin, thank you for joining us on the show. Again, everyone, our book is called Fault Lines: A History of the United States Since 1974. It's out with Norton this week. Maybe we'll make Sam an honorary author now. But you can
ask
you
me
can,
for a blurb for the paperback.
You can get it everywhere. It's on online, Amazon, Barnes and Nobles, independent book sites, and bookstores all around the country. And once again, you can get it when you want and buy some copies for friends. But thanks for joining us on Politics and Polls. You can find the show on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify. And we'll be back soon.
Thank you, Kevin.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right. Bye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.